to the political cesspool known worldwide as the South's foremost populist radio program. And here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host, James Edwards.
Welcome back to the third and final hour of tonight's live installment of the award-winning political cesspool radio program. I'm your host, James Edwards, joined by my co-host and comrade Bill Rowland, as we broadcast this evening from the studios of AM 1380 WLRM Radio, going out via satellite to the affiliate stations of Liberty News Radio Network. We're on the internet too. Go to our official website, sign up for the email list, read our blog, learn more about our show, www.thepoliticalcesspool.org. And Bill, each week without fail, we always say it. The time goes by far too quickly when we're on air, but tonight it's more true than usual, and it will continue to fly by swiftly as we introduce, as you introduce, I should say, our next very acclaimed guest.
A very acclaimed guest indeed. Our next guest is Dr. David Yeagley, and he is a member of the Comanche tribe. And his really, his bio is quite impressive. His credentials are extensive. And I'm just going to read a little bit here. It would probably take up to half an hour if I went through all of his credentials. But Dr. Yeagley has two master's degrees and a doctorate, including a Master of Divinity from Yale University, a Master of Arts in Literature and History from Emory University, and a Doctorate of Musical Arts from the University of Arizona. He also received a Bachelor of Music degree from the Oberlin Conservatory of Music and an Artist Diploma in Piano from the Hart School of Music. Dr. Yeagley is, of course, a commentator. He runs the Bad Eagle blog and website. That's badeagle.com. And I'm going to go one more here. He has taught humanities and literature at Oklahoma's College of Liberal Studies, Oklahoma State University, Oklahoma City, the University of Central Oklahoma. All of those dates and so forth are on his website, and he has appeared in various capacities in Front Page Magazine, American Enterprise, VDare.com, and numerous other programs. Dr. Yeagley, are you with us?
Yes, sir.
Well, great. It's great to have you on the show, and I want to talk, of course, start out with the BadEagle.com website and some of the columns featured here. I'm just going to mention them by title. My Father's Dragons, Jews, Blacks, and Indians. Fighting Sioux Forever, in the Tradition of the Warrior. And the one we'll probably open on tonight, The Hated White Race, which featured on here first June 16th, 2009. Dr. Yeagley, you are a conservative commentator. And by the way, welcome to our sweat lodge. But we are, you know, how did you come to these views? Obviously, many people who would listen to our show would assume that you would follow a path of, you know, sort of the liberal ideas, you know, that we assume many people of different backgrounds would have. How did you come to be so conservative and I might say, candid, outspoken, and controversial?
Well, it's a warrior thing. It's about equality. Now, I'll explain. As an American Indian, the most important thing to me is my people. To any serious Indian, being Indian is more important than professional success and material accumulation. These things are very secondary to an Indian. An Indian people with their language, their culture, their traditions, their religion, and instill some semblance of territory, these are the essential things for this life, for this identity. Our fathers gave their blood, and today's Indians give their pride. Nothing is more important than the nationhood. Now, I simply extend that philosophy, whatever you call it, an intuition of nationhood, I extend that to other people. I extend that to white people. I extend that to anybody who treasures their own ethnicity, their own nationality, their own identity. I think that's equality.
Do you think?
And therefore, I get myself into positions that seem sometimes contradictory, but I think it's perfect consistency. For instance, take Serbia. You know, this is a white nation that has been, their southern territory, namely Kosovo, has been absolutely overrun with immigration, with Albanian Muslims, and a lot of Turkish people, a lot of non-Serbian people. And I believe Serbia has a right to maintain its cultural identity and territory. And I was very disappointed when the Clinton administration, and then followed by Bush, supported the Albanian Muslims. And to just cut off a piece of Serbia and hand it to somebody else just because they moved in on the territory.
Well, I think in common with the Indians, a lot of people certainly connect their bloodline and their heritage to the land. I know that as a Southerner, I do. You know, there's an attachment to the land. And there seems to be among now, in the modern age, there's almost a nomadic mentality among all people. And do you think that that's part of the multicultural phenomenon, the diversity phenomenon? Is it since we can move anywhere, we can be anybody?
Well, I want to make a comment on that. I do not find in the American Constitution any invitation to other races, other religions, other peoples from the globe. I don't find that invitation written in the Declaration of Independence or written in the United States Constitution. And furthermore, I don't know of any European constitution that contains an invitation. The idea that anybody can live anywhere they want is a I'm afraid a modernist sort of illusion, and it's basically something that has derived from the historical facts about America, where everybody did decide to come here and it found open, pretty much open borders. And this is, I think that this is a great error, and I think that it's bound for problems, which of course we see on a daily basis. But theoretically, I have to, you know, people question why American Indian would push for American patriotism, and I say it's because, you know, on a practical basis, nobody, no government in modern times that I know of would have given the Indians a better deal. Now, yes, there were wars for several hundred years, but we wound up with some land and with some dignity, and that was bought with treaties. So we are nations within this nation, but it's historically unique that we would have been allowed such status by the conquering people. And I think that that's phenomenal. I think that America stands out towering above other regimes in that attitude towards the conquered people. And for me, what's best for America is best for Indians. And Indians need to understand that. I don't agree with this political trend of Indians trying to identify with Polynesians, Hawaiians, Southeast Asians, and all of this business. That's counter to our history.
In other words, sort of the brown revolution or the red revolution, where the Indians from the Yucatan and Indians from or Eskimos or Inuits, let's say, have something in common, when really that doesn't exist. It's an illusion created by political ideologies.
Well, I think it's leftist racism. It's nothing but racism. The idea that all non-whites have some kind of a natural affinity, and so that the entire Western Hemisphere, and including Asia, has some kind of a natural resistance to European culture and European civilization. I think this is crazy. And I think people like George Soros and his new buddy of recent years, Robert Redford, and that Sundance Film Institute up there in Utah, I got to tell you, they've got a program called Native American Documentaries. And 2 years ago, they included not only Asians, but Africans.
Okay, great. David,
Dr. Yeager?
David, we got a break. We'll focus on that and coming right back.
You got it.
Coming your way right after these messages. When the truth is found to be. Welcome back. To get on the political cesspool, call us on James's Dime, toll-free, at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
It's funny, as I hear that intro, I got an email this week. I don't remember who it's from. I beg their forgiveness. But I got an email this week from a listener who said, every time Somebody to Love is played on the political cesspool, a hippie dies. And they're probably right about that. But anyway, what a great show we're having tonight. Our featured guests, Nick Griffin and Dr. David Yeagley, both men of extreme accomplishment. And we continue on with Dr. David Yeagley right now. Bill Rowland, please, sir, continue on with the most outstanding interview.
Well, we'll pick up where we left off at the break, and that has to do with the Sundance Festival now apparently embracing virtually every race as a Native American tribe. Is that where you were? I think that's what we were discussing, Dr. Yeagley.
Yes, George Soros, the Hungarian Jew who survived basically deceived his way out of the Holocaust. He bought up the documentary division of Sundance Institute, and they started promoting all kinds of things under the Native American division. They included Polynesians, they included all the Pacific Islanders, they included Asians, and then they included Africans, and finally they included homosexuals. I mean, this was an unbelievable downward spiral, and I knew it was going to happen. The minute they identified all the Polynesians with the Native Americans, see, this is what they take the name America, and it means the entire Western Hemisphere. And if you're indigenous anywhere in the Western Hemisphere, you get associated with. They want to give that honor of the American Indian. They want to, in a sort of a Marxist fashion, redistribute that wealth and honor to all other persons of color. And it infuriates me as an Indian to see that. But that's what liberal white people do with persons of color.
Well, liberal white people do that with other white people too. But I was going to mention, you know, when we talk about the history of this country and the relations between the English, the Scottish, the Irish, and the people from the continent with the American Indian, and it's interesting because every American Indian I've ever known calls himself an American Indian, not a Native American.
So exactly.
There's a little, you know, cognitive dissonance with the liberals there. But from very early on in this country's history, there has been a relationship and sort of a mutual admiration between whites and Indians. You know, the really part of our folklore is the marriage of John Rolfe and of course John Smith and Pocahontas, and you know, certainly comments by even our founding fathers about the Indians and white people. You know, why is it of all of the races that were encountered by white settlers and by Europeans, the American Indians stand out as really receiving more admiration and seem to have more compatibility than all the other people you know, outside of Europe that the settlers encountered?
Well, the American Indian was the only group of people here that were not immigrants. I mean, they were not foreigners. The Indians were Indians. I think the initial encounters, the Indians took, you know, like many tribal people do, they took a very macho approach, meaning they played the host. These white people that washed up on the shore, they were treated with great compassion. Generally, I mean, they certainly were up in the north coastline. And I think the idea that the Indian was a savage, murdering, bloodthirsty creature developed a lot later. In the beginning, it was pretty cordial, very civilized. And I'd like to point out that among the civilized tribes in the South, there was much intermarriage and intermingling. And I point to the Scots as an example. The Scottish social structures, the clans, the tribes, the whole way in which the people live, they found a great similarity in the Cherokee and the Chickasaw, the Choctaw. It was easy to get along with them because they approached life with a lot of the same values. Now, this wasn't so true when you get out in the plains by any means, but initially, American Indians, as far as I'm concerned, the government of the United States was shaped by encounters with the American Indian every step of the way. And I tell Indian people, look at this country. See yourself in this country. This country's values, this country's government is a reflection of their Indian encounters. Look, think of America as your stepson. And yes, he grew into a giant. He didn't know he was a giant. He was just a baby when he came, but he grew into a giant. And yes, he sort of shoved us out of our homes. He was bigger than everybody else. But it's still our son. He still reflects us. And I think that we should be, proud fathers of America and take an extremely proud approach to it. And I don't know in the history of the world if there has ever been a conquering people that was so fascinated with the people that they conquered that they put their names, their images on their money, on their buildings, and named their cities after them, named the rivers, the towns, the states. And even down to the sports teams. I mean, this is remarkable. So I'm very pro, I have to say, I'm very pro Indian logo, like Fighting Sioux or Indians, Cleveland Indians, even the Washington Redskins. I think this is this reflects a very honorable character.
What a very interesting and refreshing take on that, Bill. I mean, honestly, I'll say this: until Dr. Yeagley just put it into that specific perspective for me, I hadn't really looked upon it in such a way. I certainly didn't see it as offensive, but certainly wasn't looking upon it as a way of certainly are people showing the respect there that is being displayed.
Was, so at a very profound level, something was deeply honored in the Indian, and that's why the whites took all those names. Painted the Indian's face all over the country.
You see it here in the South. I mean, I'm sure it's all over the country, but especially here in the South where we're from, everywhere, Bill, rivers, names, cities, states even, it's absolutely almost predominant.
Yes, indeed. It is. And therefore, I think that Indians have the luxury of self-congratulations. This is a new perspective to a lot of people. I'll put it this way. A lot of Indians have never heard another Indian say this. So I'm still kind of new in my effect in Indian country. It's still being digested. Because people just haven't said this before. But I even honor people like Christopher Columbus, and I tell the Indians that object to him, I said, here was a man that had courage of 10 Indians. I mean, this is one of the greatest men since Christ. said, "What?" And I tell these university professors and all these white people that try to teach Indians to knock Columbus. What do you have to offer in place of that? Do you have something great in your life that's comparable that I should honor, that I should look to, that I should be influenced by? What do you have to offer?
Well, we'll pick it up with that very provocative question, Dr. Yeagley, when we return right after these words.
We'll be back right after these messages. Get on the show and express your opinion in the political cesspool. Call us toll-free at 1-866-986-6397.
It's amazing to me, after all of the shows we've done, that we can still find ground to cover that has not yet been plowed. And credit to that is due to Bill Rowland tonight, who has booked our most excellent guest for this hour, Dr. David Yeagley. And to, listen, in being a good radio host, I know when my services are needed and when the show is going quite well without my interference. So, Bill, I just don't think there's anything I could do to improve upon the direction that you and Dr. Yeagley have taken this interview. So I am going to, once again, defer to you and let you take it away.
Okay, thank you, James. Dr. Yeagley, before the break, I wanted to bring up your ancestor, Bad Eagle, and learn a little bit about him, because obviously you hold him in high regard, and his picture is on your website. He's a very imposing figure, so he's got to have a good story.
Well, he is somebody. Bad Eagle is my great-great-grandfather on my mother's father's side. This is a direct line. I'm a direct descendant. He was a person who had experience with intercultural, international circumstances, and the story simply is that he, as a young brave, on a raid, he was captured by the Spanish army and taken down to Mexico as a captive, and he was made a Catholic. He married another Comanche captive and lived down there and had started a family down there. And at some point, and this is something that we haven't determined exactly how it came about, my mother published something on it in the Oklahoma Heritage magazine. He returned to the Comanches. I'll just put it as simply as possible. He came back to the Comanches. We're part of the what they call a Quahada, the antelope tribe of within the Comanche people, and he became a kind of modernistic leader, having seen civilization, having been taught or having somehow been informed on what was happening. The bigger picture is that the Indian life was going to pass, and he knew that even when he returned, apparently in the 1860s, somewhere in the 1860s, the Comanches surrendered, the last of the Quahada, the last of the free Comanches surrendered 1875. He was instrumental in identifying the last of the free Comanches who were hanging out in Palo Duro Canyon, and Quanah Parker was their leader, and this was of our same band. This is that Quahada Comanche group. So, in a way, some Comanches looked at him as somebody that betrayed the last of the Comanches, because he did lead the he was the informant. He was the one that knew the territory like the back of his hand, and even as a young man, and he remembered it all, and he knew where they hung out, and led that Colonel McKenzie, informed them in the 7th Cavalry where they were. So there's a certain sense that there's a stigma attached to Bad Eagle and his descendants, and I think it stems out of this incident. But he's somebody that could see that Indians were not going to be able to survive living the way that we had lived. That he knew what civilization was coming. He knew the numbers. And he knew that whatever, and this is another really important point in my thinking, he knew that whatever happened, he knew the Spanish military, the Spanish military life. He was a reconnaissance officer. We call him a scout back then. He wore the Mexican Army uniform for a time. And he knew what civilization was all about and what was going to happen to Indians. But he also knew that Indians were going to be better off under the American rule. And he chose to bring his family up to Oklahoma Territory. And this means that this was just the wisest decision that could be made at that time. That the American government, for all the problems, for what all that had happened to Indians, they were going to be better off under American rule than under Spanish rule.
Well, that's a fascinating story. I'd love to hear family stories of all kinds, but that one's really amazing.
Well, it says something about his ability to read the situation, and also it says something about what he perceived the American Indian policies to be. You know, they were going to let Indians have land. There was not going to be a Holocaust. There was never a United States government mandate for a Holocaust of American Indian people. That's a lie. There was never such government order. Now, a few army men out on the prairie in the heat of the battle, committed such, wipe out this entire village, man, woman, and child. There was that. But this does not stem from Washington, D.C. to annihilate every Indian, every living Indian.
Well, I think that's
really important because a lot of liberalized Indians like to use that word Holocaust. There was the Great Indian Holocaust. I don't think that's a proper analogy whatsoever, because Indians killed people. Indians killed hundreds of thousands of white people. Indians fought like red devils, if I can use the expression. The Jews were herded into the ovens like sheep to the slaughter. There is no comparison to what happened to Jews in Europe to what happened to Indians in America. So I want to clear that up right away.
Well, that's certainly, I would prefer to think that I belong to a tribe that fought furiously and even maybe suffered dreadfully from that than simply to have been marched off in a line to be shot or otherwise exterminated. But we're going to get to the, what I think one of the things that brought me to your site. We should have had you on the show long ago, and I apologize for the delay in that. But your article on Bad Eagle, The Hated White Race, and it comes unexpectedly because naturally whites assume that anything written by an Indian or Hispanic or anybody else is going to be anti-white. But
yes,
of course I knew you were conservative. This opening line, 50, quote, this is from The Hated White Race, which you published June 16th. Quote, 50 years from now there won't even be any white people, unquote, said my pathological Mideastern neighbor. He knew I was an American Indian, and he expected me to dance in his vision. What a poignant line. But
well,
when you encounter that kind of thing and people expect you to give a reaction and you don't give that reaction, are you recategorized immediately?
Well, I'm hated. And I will tell you that I'm at the point where I'm about to attempt to file a legal suit against my opponents who, because they cannot tolerate the thought of an American patriot, conservative, Republican, Indian, Christian, their only point of attack is, oh, Yeagley's not Indian. Yeagley's an adopted child. Yeagley was adopted by a Comanche mother. And then, you know, later they came out and said, Yeagley's mother is not Indian. Just total fantasy. When I've got all these records and I've posted them on the internet, we've got military records, we've got, the Indian rolls. I mean, there's never been any question of who we are or what we are. Never. But my political enemies, in their desperation to invalidate what I'm saying, have committed libel of, on a grand scale. And I think that once they perceive that there may be something really, you know, profoundly significant in the sense that they're threatened, their position is threatened, they resort to just raw libel.
Well, in considering, of course, that's what I say. You're immediately hated because you don't live up to their expectations. You don't dance in their vision.
And I contradict
them. You had another
them.
Confrontation like this a number of years ago when you were, I don't know whether it was at the college or what your position was, but they were even using Indian epithets or Indian stereotypes against you.
Hey, Bill, Dr. Yeagley, before you go into that, let's take one last final break for this evening. We'll come back with another full segment with Dr. David Yeagley, everyone. Sit tight.
Don't go away, the political cesspool guys. We'll be back right after these messages.
We'll return. We'll return. We'll return.
Jump in the political cesspool with James and the gang. Call us tonight at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
Here I am, James Edwards indeed, along with Bill Rowland and Dr. David Yeagley. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, to check out our website, thepoliticalcesspool.org, if you support the mission and purpose of this radio program and the guests we have on. Send us a donation online, safely, securely, with a credit card. And by all means, Bill, we've got to ask Dr. Yeagley to endorse and promote his websites and contact information as well, and I'm sure we'll do that before the time runs out of the hourglass, the sand runs out of the hourglass tonight. But, Bill Rowland, back to you, my friend.
Well, Dr. Yeagley, before the break, we'd gotten into something, but since we're running out of time here, I wanted to ask you about a historic action by the Cherokee tribe in Oklahoma, and this was the vote taken by the tribe or tribes to expel so-called black Cherokees. What did you think when you heard that?
Well, I was very proud of the Cherokee for making such a stance. I wrote an article for Front Page Magazine on that very topic. It was called "When Blacks Reject Blacks," and I held to account the NAACP and the Black Caucus in Oklahoma. Why do they not wish to accept their own race? I mean, why do they just 2,300 more people competing for food stamps in the hood? Is that why they were mad at the Cherokee tribe for dumping 2,300 more black people on them? I didn't understand the black objection to the Cherokee move there. I think that it is part of the definition, the very definition of a nation. A nation must have the authority to determine who its citizens are. If you don't have that, then you're some kind of puppet. You're controlled by somebody else. And every nation has that right. And Indian people are very few in number. A conservative estimate is under 3 million. I mean, there are a lot of pop-up tribes these days that of non-Indian people, and particularly black people back east, who claim to be an Indian tribe, so they hope to get federal recognition so they can have a casino. That's what that's all about.
That's
what the Mashantucket's are. I mean, that's a black group of people. They got the biggest resort casino in the world. You use an Indian name, a historically recognizable Indian name, and you basically it's a Negro club. with an Indian name. It's a club. It's a group. But anyway, my point is that every nation has the right to determine its citizenry, and I think America has been very, very, very lax on that. And if you permit me to be so ambitious as to use individual Indian nations as a kind of political metaphor or an analogy or an example of what it takes to maintain and be a nation, this is where I see Indians having a role in modern American political philosophy. What Indian nation would allow Muslims and Hindus and Polynesians to come in to their reservation and set up shop and run for office and become chief of the Arapaho? You know, that doesn't make sense. But I see America doing this very thing, and I say, you know, look, I say to the Americans, look at Indians. Look what we've had to do, what we've been willing to do to survive, and we're still here, and we still have a people. We're under attack through intermarriage. That's the bloodless way to destroy, a racist approach to destroying people through intermarriage. America stands in, I think, some concern over that, just in itself. But the idea of anybody can be American, anybody can come here and set up shop, an alien black African communist traitor can become president of the United States. I mean, that tells me there's a hole in this boat.
Well, isn't he the perfect left-wing eugenics specimen? The idea that the of course America and Germany and other countries had a positive, I'll say positive eugenics program, meaning that they wanted to improve their nations. Whereas in the left, the communists have a negative eugenics program, which says we're going to abolish all bloodlines. But
yes, they don't want
example of that.
They don't want any kind of differentiation. They want to destroy all boundaries, psychological, genetic, geographic. And I say that if as an Indian, if I'm going to say, look, we got to lay down our lives to protect and preserve what we got left, I extend that right to other races, other nationalities. They have the right to do that too, and that includes white people, that includes white nations, and in my mind that even includes Israel.
Well, now you've got on your blog here that a Negro president fires American Indian woman. It appears that Barack Obama is somewhat hostile to the existence of American Indians in positions of power.
He doesn't want an Indian in power over anybody else except in intertribal situations. He appointed a few people in Washington, but none of them have anything to do with anybody else, just Indian affairs. And who did he appoint over the Bureau of Indian Affairs? The Department of the Interior is Mexican, Salazar. He's basically white. He's been here for 500 years, his family. He is of Mexican descent. Okay, that's who he appoints over Indians. He's not going to appoint an Indian in any position of significant power. And the one attorney general, female attorney, Hopi Indian, in the state of Arizona, he got rid of her just as soon as he was in office.
Unbelievable. So not as multicultural as he'd like people to believe.
No, and I resent it. And Indians that have this fantasy that he's going to do something wonderful for them, I've got to clear that up quick. He's not going to do anything. He just demonstrated that.
When you encounter other American Indians and you have these discussions, you know, we, even in the South, have to overcome certain mental blocks in people. And what do you encounter among American Indians when it comes to these blocks? Do you think American Indians are more candid on these subjects or less candid? And
this is what I face. I face... The Indians that have been to the university are all liberalized. The Indians that have normally, and this is another place where I'm kind of anomalistic, because I've got all kinds of degrees, and I'm the most conservative of all, But when Indians go to the university, they generally come out very liberal. And these are the kind of people that make professional careers out of protesting mascots and stupid things like that. And I will, for example, the Sports Illustrated and the University of Pennsylvania both did the only two professional surveys on Indian opinion of the mascots and of the sports logos. Average 90% of Indians don't even care and or are not offended by mascots. And that means that most Indians think like me. They want to preserve who they are. They want to preserve their Indian nations. And I say that's conservatism. It just hasn't been articulated politically. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Well, isn't it interesting, Bill, that most Indians agree with Dr. Yeagley just as, again, most European Americans agree with us, yet we are deemed by the media elite, the plutocracy, as the outcast. It's absolutely irreconcilable, I guess. But Dr. Yeagley, we're about to run out of time this evening, and I can't tell you how much I enjoyed being a silent partner on this interview and listening to the back and forth that you and Bill had and the excellent interview that has taken place over the course of the last hour. I do want to afford to you, before we run out of time, the opportunity to give out any contact information you might have so people might learn more of you and your work.
Well, my website is badeagle.com. Just very simple, one word, B-A-D-E-A-G-L-E, badeagle.com. And on there is just a extensive amount of information, background information on me, because people are definitely challenged by, you know, how can an Indian think this way? And I feel I have to account for myself. So I've got a lot of personal background information there, and background about Bad Eagle and the family. And it's a functional website. It isn't as advanced as I'd like it to be, but we're getting there.
Well, Dr. Yeagley, badeagle.com. Ladies and gentlemen, check it out. Sir, thank you so much for spending an hour of your Saturday evening with us. We are out of time, but I want to salute you from us to you for taking the time to be with us and share your information with our audience. Godspeed to you, sir.
Thank you for having me. Thank you,
anytime.
Dr. Yeagley.
And Bill Rowland, thank you for the interview you conducted with Dr. Yeagley. What a great night. What a great evening in the cesspool with Nick Griffin and Dr. David Yeagley. Gentlemen and ladies, we are out of time, but we will see you next week right here in the Political Cesspool Radio Program. Good night, everybody.
Thanks for joining us tonight in the Political Cesspool. To learn more about us or to make a donation to keep this program on the air, go to www.thepoliticalcesspool.org.